I'm Keegan.
And I'm Madigan.
And you're listening to
Your Angry Neighborhood Feminist.
This is a podcast where we explore the world through our own personal feminist perspectives.
Sure is.
And today we're going to be talking about something that you probably have been inundated with up until this point, because I feel like every time I open a news site or I get on a streaming platform, what I'm seeing is everyone kind of revisiting 9/11, because we are coming up on the 20th anniversary.
Actually, yes.
What day does this episode come out on?
This will come out on the 13th.
So
yeah.
So we are 2 days post at the time that this episode comes out.
Yes.
And we kind of wanted to revisit it in our own way as well. And it's kind of a tough thing, right? Because like, we're a feminism podcast. So it's like, how do we look at this? But I think that we kind of came to the conclusion of like, let's look at the events of 9/11. Let's talk about it, kind of have this open discussion about it, but also talk about the quote unquote war on terror, kind of what got us there, what led us there.
What that even means.
What that means.
Yeah.
Because I do feel like a lot of the things that we are seeing now, the reverberations from this event that we are seeing now, it is a feminist issue. It's
totally.
It's a human rights issue. It's,
yeah.
All of these things. And it's kind of important with 20 years of perspective.
Yeah. Well, and it's also something that we have mentioned so many times on this show, that how everything changed in our lives after September 11th, 2001. And I think having mentioned it so many times on this show, I felt like, especially with it being 20 years out, talking about all of those things and talking about how it changed our lives and how it changed the lives of Americans, which I think also is very much a feminist issue, and that there were a lot of negative things that happened.
Well,
afterwards.
And it was like dominoes, right?
Yeah.
It was like, there's a lot of things that happened that spiraled off from this one event.
Exactly.
Right. And so like, in that way, it's kind of important to take a look at what that means. And I feel like people might think like it's hyperbolic to say that there is a before September 11th and an after September 11th if you don't remember what that was like, or if you haven't like taken a close look at it in a while, or if you're not from the United States. That might seem very like a very extreme thing to say.
Right.
But I think for those of us who remember it very clearly and remember having lived through it, it is that, like,
oh my God.
We were just talking.
I was just gonna say, we were 9 and 11 years old.
Yes,
I think
yes.
That's so weird. 9/11,
yeah.
We are 9 yeah. and 11.
Ooh,
oh my
weird.
God, that's creepy.
But we were talking, so I started watching. I only got to watch a couple of episodes. I really wish I'd been able to watch the entire documentary series, Turning Point, 9/11 and the War on Terror, which is
yes.
on Netflix. So
I was
well
watching
done.
The documentary on Hulu, which
yes.
like literally takes you through every second of the 9/11 attacks. I watched the first episode of it yesterday. It was like, I texted you because I was
yes.
like, this is surprisingly triggering.
Oh, Anthony walked in because I was watching it in the kitchen,
yeah.
you know, because I had my big screen up from work. And so I was like, I'm going to just stay in here and, you know, fill in some of my notes. And I was actually crying, and I really didn't expect to have that kind of emotional response. But there
yeah.
was something about seeing, because they actually show the footage, which I hadn't seen, I don't think, since I was 11, where they actually showed the footage of the first plane hitting the first tower.
Yeah.
And it is so shocking.
It is so shocking. And to me, the footage of the second plane was what kind of like tipped me into my panic mode, because I remember hearing about the first plane, and I remember I saw this footage
right.
in another documentary when I was like, I was probably 11. I was probably in like sixth grade when there
yeah.
was a documentary that came out, and they showed it in religion class for some reason in middle school.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing that the first time. And, you know, you're getting the footage of the firemen who are looking at like these manhole covers, because that was kind of the job they were on that morning. There were these exploding manhole covers. And then all of a sudden you start hearing the plane, and it's really, really close. And the firefighters are like looking up and looking around, like, what's going on? And then like the camera pans up.
Yes.
And you see the plane coming in.
I saw that
in.
Same footage. Yeah.
yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's like the footage of
yeah.
that, you know, mm-hmm. but there's something, and with the noise and the music and the anticipation, you're watching them look at these manhole covers, and you know what's going to happen, and you see it, and it's just like, oh my God. like nobody in there had a fucking chance.
No, I mean, and then they talk about like the people in the second tower didn't even evacuate right away.
Because
like,
a lot of like, people didn't even know. Like it was.
They didn't know it was a plane.
It happened so within minutes. Right. It happened.
And so I didn't expect those feelings to rush back. And I feel like this is kind of a touchy subject because the war on terror was so rightfully criticized mm-hmm. by a lot of progressives, right? Like, and there have been so many like human rights violations that have gone, that have spun off of this that yeah. I feel like sometimes, at least I'll speak for myself, I can almost feel like weirdly guilty for feeling like the like heartbroken about that situation. But the truth of it is like 3,000 people died. Like 3,000 people died in this like absolutely horrific, shocking event that reshaped yes. all of our childhood.
That's the thing that we shouldn't feel badly about, because I think that, you know, we talk about this like hierarchy of pain a lot, where it's like I shouldn't feel bad because someone else who's gone through it much worse than me is going to feel worse about it, or the other people who have experienced XYZ because of the war on terror deserve to feel bad more than we do. Right. But at the same time, we were literal children who saw something so unusual and so scary to see planes. Right. I mean, I remember coming home and it was on a constant repeat news.
I think I've talked about this on this show before. I'm certain I have, but yeah. I was home from school that day.
Yep.
And so we were out in a park looking for my mom's keys because we'd had a thing the night before and she'd lost her keys.
Oh, gosh.
And we got back in the car to drive back to the house, turned on the radio, and this is what they were talking about. So we sped back home in time to watch the plane hit the second tower. Mm. And I think it was, I think honestly, because I didn't really understand fully what was going on.
Right.
I think it was watching the adults in my life.
Yes.
Freak out.
Yes.
That like made me scared. And yeah. I think that there is this like it, I, you know what it is? I think it feels like privilege, right? It feels like privilege to be like, oh my God, whenever you know right. that like other countries are bombed all the time. You know,
yeah. And like but live this with this was constant something, threat. But when you're living in a world where
this doesn't happen,
it's like a Norman Rockwell America and this doesn't right. happen and America's the big winners and blah, 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 blah. Like it really did shatter everything that I believed. And also it was the first time in my life that I got political, and I was 9 years old.
Right.
And my dad is very staunchly anti-war, as is my mom. It was discussed a lot in the house. The possibility of war was discussed a lot in the house. And I had a very specific idea in my head of what that looked like. And I was raised in such a way that made me hate it so much that it made me want to understand why are we going to war? What is going on? Why am I afraid?
See, I think my family was in that like 90% of Americans. Definitely my family was in that 90% of Americans who in the days following 9/11, which that's how long it took, days.
I'm pretty sure it was like September 13th that we declared war.
Well, we hadn't declared war, but we had like on September 15th, I think is whenever the like that whatever was drafted was approved.
Yeah.
Legally. So we'll definitely talk about that. But yeah, I mean, like the reason why I think it's important to set up our reactions, our emotional reactions to watching this footage again as adults and yeah. having those kind of like visceral, oh my gosh, I feel like I'm back in that moment reactions.
Yeah. Which I was not expecting.
Which I wasn't expecting either, is because it does take you back to that like fear and that like anger and that like grief
yeah.
that we felt at the time, which is what got us into the war on terror. Like
exactly.
that's really what
propelled us.
It was revenge.
We wanted revenge, and that's what got everybody on board with this war in the first place, which yeah. morphed into this crazy, crazy thing. Mm-hmm. I wanted to state something really quick, because as I was doing notes and realizing all of the dates, mm-hmm. I went to Disney World on October 9th, 2001.
What?
Yes. So that was my like golden birthday present for turning 9 on July 9th. I got to, you know, in October in the fall, my family and I went to Disney World.
I'm surprised that commercial planes were like back up and like doing their thing by
then. Yeah. I remember, so my family and I always would take like the first flight in the morning. So we'd be getting up at like 3 a.m. to call a taxi and get downstairs and be ready to go.
Yeah, miss all the traffic.
And I remember sitting in the kitchen being like, I don't want to go. I don't want to do it. Like, I was so scared to go to the airport. It was, and my parents having to sit me down and be like, look, they've got all these new things in place. We're going to be okay. And I was like, I'm going to Disney World. Like, that's a big place too. Like, am I going to be vulnerable because I'm in this like
big
space and being so scared to fly less than a month after this happened? Why we did this, yes. I will never understand.
Yeah, because again, we were living in this very safe feeling kind of bubble.
And then all of a sudden it was just popped.
And three planes full of people, no survivors. Like that, it's terrifying. It like truly, terrifying. You know?
Yeah. So, all right, let's get started on the actual events of the thing.
Yeah, now that we have our thoughts and feelings kind of out on the table, I do want to say at the top of this episode, write in and let us know. Like, let us know where you were when you heard the news. What were your feelings?
Oh, I want to know.
Like, what were you feeling? Because, again, I know that it's now with so much hindsight, it's a complicated inner feeling about this whole thing. But those feelings that you had or maybe do still have are totally valid. And I want to hear about it. So,
and they also helped play into our feelings, I think, as the war went on for 20 years. Like,
right.
I mean, how we felt on that day is no matter what you were feeling.
And regardless politically of where things ended up, 3,000 people who had families and lives.
Yep.
Who didn't know when they woke up that morning that they weren't going to be coming home.
Yeah.
Died.
Yeah.
And like, we can grieve that. Like,
yeah. These were not people living dangerous lives, working dangerous jobs. These were people going to
work like we would go to work.
An office building.
I work in an office. You know, like, you know, it's just.
It's terrifying.
It is. It's scary. Okay. So let's, in order to kind of understand the war on terror, we need to like take it back. So get in your way back machine. We're going to take it back.
Rewind.
So this whole thing kind of began when Soviet troops invaded and occupied Afghanistan in 1979.
Yes.
So because we were in a Cold War with the Soviet Union at the time, and they had like so flagrantly kind of like gone outside of their borders, the U.S. was like, no, 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 we cannot have this.
Yeah.
Like, we can't have them just invading other regions. You know, it's not safe bringing communism to other regions or whatever.
Right.
So Ronald Reagan sent the U.S. in to make sure that the Afghan people won against the Soviets. So he basically created a new wing of the CIA. They hired some military people and they were like, we will give you $1 billion or more if you need more. Make sure the Afghans win this war. Like, yeah. That's basically, they were like, make sure the Soviets do not win there.
Right.
So by 1985, 1 million Afghans had been killed in this battle between the U.S. and Soviets. Like,
right.
It had
nothing to do with them, but it was being fought on their turf.
Right. And yeah. as far as the Afghan people were concerned, it did have to do with them because it was like their homeland, right? And so they're
right.
Like,
the
well,
fight
we're gonna
didn't
fight.
Have to do with them, but yeah. They were being brought into it because their people were being killed and it was happening on their land.
Right. So 1 million Afghans had been killed in essentially a six-year period.
Oh, God.
And then 1.5 million were wounded, and then millions of others had fled or had been driven out to areas like Iran and Pakistan.
Okay.
So to help the Afghan people fight the Soviets, the United States was giving billions of dollars to the Mujahideen. And they were Afghans who rose up on the basis of Islam. So they were like basically resistance fighters, but they were a religious based resistance fighter kind of like organization.
Okay.
And they rose up to like free their country from Soviet occupation. And they were a militia group.
Yeah.
They considered themselves jihadis, which means a struggle to fight against the enemies of Islam. So you can kind of see where this is going. The United States is funding jihadists at this point because we're trying to fight the Soviets.
Yes.
So there were several Mujahideen groups at this time, and one of the leaders was a man named Hek Machar, and he was an extremist who was said to have started the practice of throwing acid in women's faces if he deemed them to be immodest. Because
oh my gosh.
Prior to the Soviet occupation, Afghanistan was pretty modern. Like, people dressed in modern clothing in the 1970s.
Yes, there are photos that I've seen very recently on, like, different history Instagram post things that I follow, mm-hmm. where they were showing the differences between, you know, women in miniskirts in the 70s in Afghanistan versus the women's faces being painted over on the advertisements today.
And this is kind of the first inkling you're seeing of that, right? Of, like, this group is going in and
taking control.
And yes, they're fighting the Soviets to try and get their land back.
But they're also taking control over the country.
They're religious fundamentalists. So it's not just the Soviets they're fighting. They're also, they're like, we need to adhere to these very strict fundamentalist Islamic beliefs.
Right.
Right. So America was giving these leaders sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars a month to arm themselves. And we bought them crates of AK-47s, rocket launchers, grenades. By 1988, young men were coming from all over different countries, especially in the region alongside, and they started joining these groups, and they called themselves Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. So their leader was a man named Osama bin Laden. You may have heard of him. Heard about this guy? Who, despite having grown up in a modern, well-off family, like we just said, you know, people were dressing in modern clothing. It's not how you think of.
Well, and honestly, that was something during this research that was very surprising to me, learning more about Osama bin Laden.
Yeah, his family, he was wearing kicking it in jeans and a polo. You know what I mean?
For real. That was is the image of his life before we knew who Osama bin Laden was is very different than the image you have in your head of what he looks like in his terrifying videos that he would put out, you know?
Yeah. But he was radicalized by fundamentalism.
Yep.
And so he felt the need to join the jihad. In 1989, the U.S. was supplying the Mujahideen with Stinger missiles, which were designed to take down planes from the ground. So you could stand on the ground with one of these giant missiles and you could take down Soviet planes.
Right.
I want to make it very clear right now that the problem here is not the Afghan people trying to resist
the Soviets.
Occupying force, right? Like, yes. They have every right to try and protect themselves.
As is war. Like, that's the name of the game.
Right. I mean, like, these people are coming in to your homeland. Like, you do have the right to protect yourself. I'm not at all saying that you don't have the right to resist. You should be resisting.
Of course.
The issue became that we were funding and supplying military-grade weapons and training to a religious fundamentalist group.
Like, exactly.
The issue was that it was
It's not that we are helping. The issue wasn't that we were helping them protect themselves. The issue was who we were employing to help protect Afghanistan.
And at the end of the day, we weren't trying to protect them. It had nothing to do with them.
I'm sure it wasn't even a big issue for the United States as to whether or not who was fighting against the Soviet Union.
We didn't even think about it.
We didn't care. All we cared about was the fact that we couldn't have the Soviet regime take over the world.
Right.
That is what the U.S. cared about.
So I want to make that clear before we move forward is, like, especially since I know we're going to talk about the Islamophobia that happened post the 9/11 attacks. This is not an attack on Muslim people. This is not an attack on Afghan people. This is not an attack, you know, on Islam. This is an attack on
a fundamentalist group. I mean, it's the same thing as, you know, looking at your everyday Christian groups
compared to the Westboro Baptist Church.
Exactly.
Right. It's
or
different.
Looking at the polygamist guy. What's his name?
Warren
Jeffs. You know, all of these very extreme high control groups. That's a very, very, very different thing than what the actual religion is.
Right. And so I want to make that very clear before we move forward, because a big part of the issues that we saw with a lot of the xenophobia, Islamophobia, racism in our country post 9/11 had to do with people not being able to make that distinction.
100%.
So,
I feel like this stuff wasn't talked about.
No.
You know what I mean?
All.
Like, this wasn't something that I think a lot of, and I was too young to know, but I feel like it wasn't something that people educated themselves on. I'm like,
who
is the group that we're giving this money to?
It was all Muslims were going to try and enact Sharia law in the United States. Like, that was the rhetoric everywhere, you know?
So we'll talk more on that.
But okay. So once the Stinger missiles came in, it was basically all over for the Soviets. And by the fall, they had surrendered. And America was basically like, okay, great job, everybody.
You did good.
They're like, we won, deuces. And they just left, right? Which essentially handed over control of Afghanistan
to Al-Qaeda,
to the newly formed, highly trained, well-armed militant groups. And they were now calling themselves the Taliban.
Yeah.
So we did this. I want to go ahead and say that right now. A lot of the issues, like going into like save them or whatever, like we were saving them from tyranny. We caused the tyranny. Like we
gave the money and the weapons to the wrong fucking people. This was our fault.
Right. So in the 90s, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, which is very close to Saudi Arabia, which of course holds a lot of the world's oil production. So in order to protect our oil interests, the U.S. immediately sent troops to Saudi Arabia. Now, around this time, Osama bin Laden had been trying to convince his followers that the United States was a threat to their way of life.
Yeah.
And this was hard because the U.S. had armed them. They'd helped them defeat the Soviets. Right. This was a big win.
But I think that, and this is probably what you're about to say, but Osama bin Laden being a fundamentalist leader,
right,
it sees Western culture, yes, as being immoral and mm-hmm. wrong. And so I feel like it was more on a moral playing ground of why we need to, you know, get rid of Western culture,
yes,
rather than looking at it like they were the ones that gave us the money. They're like, no, maybe they helped us out, but the way they're living their lives is
right.
wrong.
From a religious standpoint, yes, it doesn't matter that they helped us out. And
exactly.
Like, there are these two giant Western powers, right? The Soviets, we got rid of them.
Yep.
But there's the U.S. But a lot of the members were arguing, the Al-Qaeda members, they were like, well, I mean, I hear what you're saying, but they're not a direct threat to us. They're not here anymore. They left,
right,
and they left us with all of these weapons, and they taught us how to arm, you know, like, so they were saying to Osama bin Laden, like, you know, I think the U.S. is fine.
Yeah.
Until we decided to go to Saudi Arabia.
Right.
Like, once we entered Saudi Arabia, Osama bin Laden could make the argument that, like,
look, they're actually mm-hmm. against us.
Right.
And look, everything I told you is true. They right. are people to be feared.
And, you know, the biggest natural resource for the Middle East is their oil, and for, like, you know, the Muslim world is the oil production,
right,
in that region. And so he's arguing that, like, they're coming here to try and take our resources and take our oil and try and force us into their, like, Western Christian way of life,
which honestly is not that far off with the colonizing we've done in our history. I
would be skeptical as well. Yeah,
I can totally see. And they already came in and gave us all this stuff. What's to say they're not going to come in again and enforce their way of life on
right.
us?
Right, exactly.
You know, obviously he's taking it to a place that isn't logical. But if you are looking at it in just like the logical sense,
because it's
I can understand wanting to keep your way of life.
Right. Because it's based in religion. All of this is a problem because it's based in religious extremism. Like,
right.
that's why it's an issue.
Like, exactly.
The concept that the Western world, or like the United States or Britain or whoever, that they will come in and take your resources and colonize your land.
They will.
There's precedent for that.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, they will do that.
Yeah.
So that is a genuine fear to have.
Right. But that I think adding all of the other fears that he was kind of explaining to his followers and things like that probably became much more real when they were seeing what was happening in Saudi Arabia. I mean,
right.
Okay, well, maybe you're right.
Right. And, you know, I also do think that, like, Osama bin Laden wanted, the U.S. was an enemy because
yeah.
of the way we live here.
Yes.
Like, capitalism and everything else, like the way that we live here. And so, honestly, we handed it to him on a silver platter when we were like, okay, well, we're going to go occupy Saudi Arabia to protect our oil interests. You know
and
what I mean?
We already just gave you all these weapons and money for you to be able to fight mm-hmm. back.
Yeah. So because of this, he was able to convince his followers that it was time to declare jihad on the United States. In 1993, a bomb went off at the World Trade Center. And while Al-Qaeda was not directly involved, it was carried out by members of another jihadist group who had sought to topple both towers. Like, that was their plan. And whenever like they were taking the guy who was responsible away,
yeah,
they drove him past the World Trade Center towers and they were like, look, they're still standing. And he said, if I had enough money, they wouldn't be. Right.
Mm.
So luckily, though, they were unsuccessful, and only, I hate to say only, but only six people were killed in that blast.
Right.
Later that year, another plot was uncovered to bring the towers down, but it was thwarted at the last minute. So we have two plots by jihadist groups wanting to take down the towers up till this point, right?
And what, I mean, so the World Trade Center's towers, they were the tallest buildings in the country. So yes. Is that the main reason why they were so intent on the World Trade Center?
I think because it represented trade and like commerce, that it represented capitalism.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah. And because to me, I was always like, is it just because it's like the biggest?
I think that's probably part of it too. It's like, it's symbolic to take down the tallest buildings in New York City.
Well, and it's and the World Trade Center towers also made up such a huge part of the skyline and everything as well. I mean, you can't watch a Friends episode without their little, horrible. It is the most sad, like depressing thing, because they show the little in-between shots of the city of New York and you see these twin towers and, you know, one of them's got that kind of like spoke that comes out the top.
Yeah.
And it's such an iconic American image. Kind of like image, you know, so I can understand. But at the same time, I was always kind of like, well, then why? But why there? And I do kind of understand.
Yeah,
more
I feel
now.
Like it was symbolic. Like, I feel like it was this representation of trade in the United States and like represented everything about like Western life, maybe.
That makes sense.
You know, I don't know for sure, but that would be kind
of... Because like the White House and the Pentagon, like that all makes a lot of sense to me. Mm-hmm. The World Trade Centers throughout my life has always been kind of like, well, why there? Mm-hmm. And especially now hearing, you know, knowing that there were multiple attempts and tries on this exact building, one... Why wasn't security like majorly ramped the fuck up?
I mean, I guess nobody really thought that someone's gonna drive a plane into one. You know what I mean?
Like, I guess maybe because there were failed attempts and we thwarted it, we thought that maybe it wasn't gonna be an issue.
And they were bombs, right? Like those were bombs, which is bad.
Yes.
But it's not the same. I don't know that we had any comprehension that someone would fly a commercial plane full of people. Full into, of civilians into the tower. Like, I just don't think
we got to get to that day. Let's keep talking. We got to get to it. Oh my God.
So by 1996, Bin Laden was openly declaring war on the United States. This is when he's doing these interviews.
Yeah.
Right? He's in all these newspapers. And like I said, he came from a pretty well-to-do family. So he had financial backing and he'd been backing these like extremist groups. Right. And that's when he had been, I think, in the Sudan, and the Sudan had a relationship with the United States, and they're like, what do you want us to do with him?
Right.
And they were like, well, we can't take him because we don't have enough to like arrest him on. And so they were like, send him back to Afghanistan, which was the worst thing that we could have decided to do, because it's like, send him back to a place where he has a following, where we have trained them and given them a bunch of weapons. So we were like, cool, cool. So around this time is when he returned to Afghanistan. And by then, of course, Taliban groups had a hold on this country. Like it in those years,
they were in total control.
In total control. Like, you know, they were... There was a civil war, essentially, and the way it's described in this documentary that I watched, like, it was peace, but it was this draconian, like, medieval peace, where it was just like, yeah, people weren't killing each other, but they weren't killing each other because the Taliban would kill you and your whole family, you know,
right, like, because you had to stay in line.
Right, exactly. Yeah. It was this religious dictatorship at this point.
Right.
So after several attacks on U.S. embassies in the late 90s, he fixed his eyes on a new target. And that target was the World Trade Center towers.
Right.
So let's talk about 9/11, shall we?
Let's do it. So there were four crashes on September 11th, 2001. And, oh God, I mean, I don't have a ton of details with all of this because we are talking about the war on terror in general. So I have a bit of a timeline that I got from history.com that will kind of get us started. In the early morning hours of September 11th, 2001, 19 hijackers led by Al-Qaeda took control of four commercial airlines. At 8:45 a.m., five of those hijackers crashed Flight 11 into the northern-facing side of the North Tower of the World Trade Center. And it was only 18 minutes later that another five hijackers crashed flight 175 into the southern facing side of the South Tower. So it all happened really, really fast.
Yeah. And like I said, like, people didn't know what happened. They didn't know it was a plane. And even though the towers appear to be very close, they interviewed people who were on the south side of the South Tower.
Yeah.
And the plane hit the north side of the North Tower.
Right.
And they were like, I heard a boom, but it wasn't even like this catastrophic boom. I was like, okay, maybe it's a bomb again, because yeah, there had been bomb attempts. But I didn't think we were in danger.
Yeah.
Like, they were like, I didn't think we even needed to evacuate.
Well, that's what I was going to say. A lot of people didn't even evacuate. There were people that were in that when they were hurt in the South Tower, didn't even know about the North. You know what I mean? Like, these buildings are so huge.
Right.
They're huge that a plane can go through one of them and the building right next door is not aware of what happened. Right. Which is crazy.
They heard something, but they didn't think like, oh, this is urgent. Like, we need to get out of this building right now.
Yeah. You know? I mean, the people in the North Tower, for the most part, were very aware and were starting to evacuate. Yeah. But it is weird to think about the fact that there was still like some semblance of peace literally right next door.
Right. And I do want to say also, because of where the plane hit, it took out all of the stairwells.
Yeah.
So if you were above where the plane hit, so if you were above, like, I think they said like the 90th floor.
I think it was the 70 something floor on the north side.
If whichever, I remember
from the
sure.
documentary, it was like the 77th, 78th or something like that.
Yeah. If you were above that floor, there was no way to get out. Yeah. I mean, there was no way to get out. You couldn't take a stairwell, nobody could get to you.
And oh my God. And firefighters were losing their minds because they're like, we got to take an elevator because taking the stairs is going to take too long. And there were no elevators that were working. So these men in their whole gear are having to, you know, climb hundreds of flights of stairs.
Right. I mean,
to try to save who they
and
can.
And people were getting hurt on the elevators because in the North Tower, there was like a fuel something that like burst. And so people were coming out of the elevator with like
soot.
Burns.
Yeah.
Like third degree burns. Like, yeah. So I will give a trigger warning. If you're going to watch Turning Point on Netflix, that stuff. Like the burning. Like,
yeah.
They show it.
It's a lot. There was a man who was interviewed in the Hulu documentary that I was watching who was like a cook in the North Tower. And he was talking about how he was on like the second floor. He's like, it's going to be faster if I just take the elevator than take the stairs. And I guess this guy who was with him is like, no, you're not supposed to take the elevator in this kind of instance. I'm going to take the stairs. And he was like, if this door opens, I'm taking the elevator. He said, I took the elevator and I never saw that other guy again.
Right. I mean, but it was a toss up because there were also people who died on the elevator.
Exactly.
So it was kind of just like you had to take your chance.
Yeah.
Right. Like, it became very irrational because,
I mean, people were jumping.
Right?
Yeah, there's no, I mean, we were talking about this with Kabul, with the airplane, the Afghan people, you know, attaching themselves to the airplane, knowing there's no way they're going to be able to hold on for an entire flight.
Yeah. Right.
And it was the same kind of thing for these very desperate people that were just like, I cannot get out. And honestly, like, I feel like with my fight or flight senses, I would end up doing the same thing. I'm like, I'm just going to run and jump.
I agree. I probably.
And I don't mean that in a callous way, but it's like, it's that fear that takes over you. It's like, what are you supposed to do that moment?
And again, not trying to be like too graphic or too callous, but also when you're faced with the possibility of burning to death
or choosing,
like maybe something will happen, or maybe I'll die before I hit the ground.
Yep.
You know, like, I probably would do the same thing.
Honestly, and this is very morbid, but there is something to me that I would feel like choosing my method of death and saying,
it's your agency.
It's your agency. Yeah. Exactly. Then saying, I'm going to sit here and wait to see what happens.
Yeah.
Instead of being like, no, I am in a dangerous position. And even if I may die doing this, I'm going to fucking try. And I mean, man, humans are crazy. Humans are crazy the way that we can accomplish good and bad things. At 9:37 a.m., five hijackers flew flight 77 into the Pentagon. And then at 10:03, the very infamous flight 93 crashed into a Pennsylvania field after the passengers fought back against the hijackers. And the target was believed to be the Capitol or the White House. I mean, flight 93 is such an incredible story. I was listening to the the phone conversations in the Hulu documentary that I was watching. And it really is, I couldn't believe the calm.
That is what I think
too.
She
was calling like she was a secretary at a dentist's office, checking on your appointment. Like, it was so calm. She was so, there's people in the cockpit, they're doing this. And she
was, I think we've been hijacked. It's the most wild thing.
But she's saying it even more chill than you just said it.
Yeah, exactly.
It's unbelievable to me that she was able to keep that level of calm, but they were able to get these 911 calls out and speak to somebody before, you know, all communication was cut out. And essentially, you know, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda came in with mace and pepper spray and weapons and overtook this plane and went into the cockpit. And these passengers were like, let's take a vote. They took a vote. They're like, we're probably going to die anyways. Do we do our best to fight against these guys and try to take control back over this plane? Or do we just allow this to happen? And over the phone, you can hear them saying, somebody's like, push it, push it. And they're talking, I mean, I would assume maybe like a beverage cart or something. They're trying to break this door down to get into the cockpit. And they scared these guys enough and freaked them out enough that they ended up flying into an open field rather than continuing to go to their full destination.
Yeah, which they landed in Pennsylvania. It is
the most heroic act, even though, I mean, I'm pretty sure all of them died as
they
well,
did.
Correct?
Every person on all of the flights
but
died.
But they fought like hell. They were like, if we're going to go down either way, we're going to do everything in our power to make sure that we at least prevent, and they, because they had also heard about the World Trade Center,
which is probably why they felt that way, right?
They were because like, we need to protect everybody on the ground now.
Yeah, because for sure, it doesn't make the people on the other flights any less courageous. They just had less information. What I mean? Like, these people had so much
information. This was the last flight. They were able to hear from people on the ground what was going on and what happened, so they were able to make a decision that, look, we're gonna die either way, we're gonna at least try to save lives of people who are building.
It makes me emotional because I just had this flashback thinking of those like recordings of like in the days and weeks after 9/11, they on the news, because it was like the beginning of the 24-hour news cycle. So our TV didn't go off. We all slept in the living room. The TV stayed on.
I mean, that's why I'm saying I literally saw the plane crashes 100 times in the first 24 hours because it never stopped.
They played the first like couple of nights. They played all of the like, I'm going to cry. Okay. They played all of the voicemails that people left their loved ones on the plane, like when they knew that, like,
they were going,
we're
down.
Going down, like, I love you, you know, like all of those messages. And I know that this is kind of like off topic, but it is such a beautiful reminder of like, in the midst of this like horrific thing, this like ugly, ugly thing, like every call that was made was a call of love. Like, there wasn't any like
hatred
or
anger,
or malice, or it was all like, and I do think that that's such a beautiful reminder of like what human beings are at our core, you know, like what we are like. I know I'm taking it into like a really sappy direction.
No, but I think that that's a really good point. And it's also important to mention because, again, these are the things that we were inundated with nonstop for months after this happened. We were hearing every little bit of information that we could because all of it was broadcast. All of it was broadcast. And it was so devastating to hear. And I remember hearing the story of Flight 93 and the heroism of the people on the flight. I mean, George W. Bush made a whole speech, you know, thanking everybody for everything that they did.
Yeah.
It was a huge, huge moment. In the end, 2,977 people died that day, making it the deadliest attack on U.S. soil in history. And that's why we have that response,
right?
Because it was the deadliest attack that has ever occurred where we live. And although we know it happens in other places all the time, that is not something we are used to or accustomed to. We are supposed to be the big good guys that are protected.
Especially in the 90s. Like, I can't overstate the vibe that America had in the 90s. Like, we were coming off of, like, knocking down the Berlin Wall. Like, we yeah. were like, we're the liberators. We're the, like, we're the winners, right? Like,
and that was had our, been the winners.
And I mean, that's how we
if
felt.
If you look at, you know, World War One until 9/11, we were the victors and the good guys and the people that came in and saved yeah. the day.
I mean, even Vietnam, which was incredibly unpopular, right? And, like, you can't say we quote unquote won, but there were still a lot of people who argued that, you know, we were doing the right thing or whatever. Like, right. so... The vibe at that time was very patriotic in a way that I don't think Gen Z can understand because it's post 9/11 and everything changed.
Yeah.
Like in the 90s, you felt lucky to be an American, like genuinely.
Yeah. I bought a new Old Navy shirt for the 4th oh, yeah. of July every single year.
I had a Stars and Stripes bandana that I wore all the time. You know, like, and again, we can... That's not necessarily a good thing, right? Right. America definitely had a lot of problems prior yeah. to 9/11. Like, we did a lot of shitty stuff, but we didn't feel it as citizens. Right.
The camaraderie right. was different than it right. is now. Yeah, yeah.
So that night, when Bush addressed the nation, he made it clear that we were going to respond with military action.
Yep.
And that we were going to go to war. I mean, I don't think that there was a doubt in anybody's mind. And again, we were all coming off of this.
No, and that's what everybody
this.
Wanted, yeah, I feel like.
We
like
were coming off of extreme emotion.
Yeah, most yeah. of the country was like, fuck yeah. And I mean, even the words he used, like, we're going to take them down,
oh, yeah.
all this stuff was like, I mean, was criticized very heavily later because, like, what military
but it
commander
wasn't just him.
Is going to...
It wasn't yeah. just him. It was like Hillary Clinton was saying the same shit. Like, yep. it was a pretty bipartisan issue.
Everybody was pissed and wanted to go to war except for Frank Haggerty.
Frank?
Because in my house, it was like... My idea of war, and I think I've said this on the podcast before, I loved Molly, my American Girl doll, and I loved her books. Mm-hmm. And I remember like her talking about like having sugar rations and all this stuff. And I just remember being like, I don't want my candy to go away. Like that was like wow. a legitimate thought in my 9-year-old mind.
That's so funny because it's the most privileged like American thought we could have about war.
We're
like,
I know.
I don't want my gummy bears to be rationed.
Like,
you know?
Don't ration my sugar. I mean, if you know me, you know I have the biggest sweet tooth in the world. Like I have a second stomach for sweets. Like it's on another level. So it makes sense for little 9-year-old Maddie. But that was my idea of what it was going to be. Like we suddenly were going to be in this like World War II era hardship, we're going
it's,
to war
it's funny.
Kind of thing. Which in a way we did. It just wasn't in the way that I was picturing it.
It's
the
it's
morning after.
Because it's so counter to my family who were so in that like USA number one, we're number one mindset.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the nation was in that mindset, like we said, coming out of the 90s, that we were like, we're going to go to war.
Yeah.
And we're going to squash them. Like they don't know what they don't know who they mess with.
Yeah.
And like there's video of people basically saying that. They're like, 100%. They don't know who they messed with. Like America,
we're coming for you.
Is coming. Yeah. Right. And like the full force of our military is coming. Like
but
that's,
my dad was a product of, you know, he was a young adult male in the Vietnam era. He luckily wasn't drafted because of his hearing, but he lost so many friends. So to him in his mind it's
like a better mindset to have. I'm not
right,
arguing that it's
totally
not.
But like in his mind it was like nothing positive is going to come out of this. And no, that was what I was inundated with. So the fact that people were
have.
So gung-ho mm-hmm. about this war,
yeah.
I was not. I yeah. was absolutely terrified about what that would mean for me mm-hmm. and what that would mean for my family and my friends and my country, where everybody else around me at school the next day was like, even the kids, I'm in fourth grade.
Oh yeah.
And these kids are like gung-ho, ready to like,
they're hearing their parents say that. You
exactly.
know what I mean?
Exactly. But to me, I was so like, oh my God, what world am I in now? Why do none of you agree with me? I didn't understand why all these people were so like, yay, we're going to go to war. And I was like, no, this is really, people are going to fucking die.
I mean, it's an interesting thing talking to you about it because, I mean, of course we knew that going to war meant people were going to die. But I think I was so inundated in that post 9/11 unity
yeah.
that happened because I have never seen anything like that before or since.
Yeah.
The way that the country came together was I've never seen anything like it.
I mean,
like,
we thought we were patriotic before 9/11. That year afterwards was even more so,
It was wild. It was like we all set our differences aside for like at least a second.
Yeah.
Well, not entirely because of the Islamophobia.
Yes.
It was a very strange time.
Well, and Bush's popularity rose as well.
Oh, because presidents, their popularity always rises.
And that is wild to me. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this, my point of view was not the popular point of view, essentially, is what I was getting at.
So it wasn't long before we figured out kind of like there had been lots of threats by bin Laden up until this point. There had been lots of attacks, actually, like U.S. embassies had been attacked. There had been like a Navy boat off of.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that had been attacked.
I mean, the list on Wikipedia is very, very long.
Right. So we knew kind of like, OK, who are our enemies? Who might be behind this? Who has tried to attack the World Trade Center before?
Right.
And it wasn't long before we figured out that most likely Al-Qaeda were behind these attacks. And so right from the start, America was America was ready to exercise our full military might to take down whoever did this.
Yeah. Oh, and I did want to mention really, really quick one thing with kind of going off of what we were talking about is that, you know, Osama bin Laden came out with all of these, I guess, like, reasons why he was attacking against America, mm-hmm. and George W. kind of simplified it all to like, they hate us for our freedoms. Right. And that was such
and a... we clung to that.
That's what I thought it was, mm-hmm. for yes. most of my life, was this almost like jealousy kind mm-hmm. of thing.
We had a very mean girl mentality about it. It's like they hate us because they ain't us kind
exactly.
of situation. You know,
like they can't have what we have, so they're going to try to take down what we have. And to me, that's very much what he was conveying.
Well, it was very strategic for them to say it that way. Uh-huh. Like they wanted the American people, and for reasons that we will get into, I promise we're gonna get into it. There were reasons that they wanted to make sure that we stayed as angry as possible.
Yep.
And as unified, like all of that unity that I spoke of, while a beautiful thing in many ways, I feel like was very strategic on the government's part.
It was creating a mob mentality.
Right. They were like, we need to stay together, united as Americans, and we need to stay really, really mad at all of those people over there. Don't think about where they're from, because we're going to talk about the invasion of Iraq, right?
Yeah.
So they're like, don't think about any of that and whether or not they actually had anything to do with 9/11, because they're all other, right?
And
all of those people.
And they're all together.
Right.
Like, there was the idea that, like, one was all. One terrorist attack could be tied to all these different groups, all these different things. It wasn't a war with Afghanistan.
Yes.
It was a war on terror.
Which is, you know, why we wanted to talk about this, because you can argue whatever you want about us going into Afghanistan to try and pull bin Laden out. But the war on terror, quote unquote, was far reaching.
Yes.
And went far beyond that.
Oh, yes.
So.
Well, Bush's objectives were nothing that was tangible. It was like, we are going to take down every terrorist organization in the world when they come to be. Like,
right.
When,
we're
going
to eliminate
terror,
which it's not possible.
It's like,
not even feasible. But it became known fairly quickly that the Taliban had provided a safe haven for bin Laden, who had not only planned but also bankrolled this attack.
Right.
And so everybody,
this privileged fucking rich kid.
Seriously. I'm talking not only Bush, but also Clinton, meaning Bill Clinton, Biden, Hillary Clinton, everybody, they were basically like, no, we need to not only get bin Laden, but we need to get everybody who aided and abetted him.
Yeah.
Right? So on September 13th, for the first time ever, NATO invoked Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty, which commits each member state to consider an armed attack against one member state to be an armed attack against them all. So this was the first time this happened, where NATO was like, listen, you come for one of us, you come for all of us.
Right.
So they came for the United States. And so NATO was like, okay, we're going to back you in like whatever you do next. And so the issue was that we had never declared war against a terrorist group before. Like,
right.
This was not a country. Like we said, this was an idea.
Yeah.
So how do you even do that?
Right.
And so Bush had his people draft up the authorization for use of military force against terrorists, or AUMF. And it was basically saying that it would authorize the president to use all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11th. So it was incredibly broad.
Well, and this was, is this something where the president could decide it and didn't have to go through Congress?
Right. He wanted Congress.
Because that will continue where, like, there is, because I believe there was something that Obama did as well. I'm not there in my notes yet, but there was something where it was like the president doesn't have to get approval from Congress for certain things when it comes to this
right.
war.
Well, from what I understood, he didn't even have to get approval for this because it was such an extreme situation, but he
right.
wanted to. He wanted Congress to sign off on it. So they drafted this thing, but the terms of it were so broad that there were talks from politicians kind of on both sides of the aisle who were like, ooh, I don't know. I feel like this is an overreach. I feel like it gives him too much power because it doesn't specify where, when, or how the president is authorized to use force.
Right.
It simply says against any organization, associated forces, or individuals who are connected in any way.
Yeah, I mean, one of the objectives was to reject sponsorship, support, and sanctuary to terrorists, reduce underlying conditions that terrorists seek to exploit. I mean, like, these are things that are so arbitrary that it does leave a lot of, opened...
A lot of gray area.
Yeah, and a lot of openings for the president then to
kind abuse
of,
it.
To abuse it and to decide whatever the fuck he wants to do with
right.
that.
You can see very clearly how it could go off the rails, right?
Yeah.
And there was only one person, and she's just chef's kiss, lovely. There's only one person who voted no on the blanket authorization of use of military force, and that was Congresswoman Barbara Lee. And I'm talking
Barbara.
One person in the Senate or the House. Everybody, again, because of the high emotion, I think.
Let the women do the work. That is from another podcast that I love, True Crime Obsessed, where they say it all the time.
Well,
come on, let the women do the work.
So she said when she gave her statement, because everyone was getting up there giving their statements about, you know, Democrat, Republican, they were all up there saying, we need to strike back. This is the only language they understand is force. So we need to go in with force, right?
Right.
And she said, I am convinced that military action will not prevent further acts of terrorism against the United States.
Yeah.
And she also believed that the way that the AUMF was written, it could potentially put us in a situation where U.S. troops are left in harm's way forever. It's
yeah.
like we don't have anything written in here.
Yeah.
About how are we getting them in? How are we getting them out?
How are we going to end this war?
How are we going to end it?
Right.
Because it's just, it's
we
open-ended.
We should have listened to Barbara Lee because she literally saw the future.
Right. I mean, and I think she did speak up recently with everything that's going on in Afghanistan.
I hope so.
To not say this, but to say, I told you so. You know what
yeah.
I mean? Like, this is why I was the only dissenting voice.
Yeah.
And because she was the only dissenting voice, when she got back to her hotel or her office, already in the time, because that was a live televised event, in the time she got back, hundreds of death threats,
yep.
calling her treasonous, calling her a traitor, active death threats on her life for saying she didn't want to go forward with this particular agreement.
But she makes so much fucking sense.
No, but
you know, there
were
is this
emotional.
Like eye for an eye thing where it's like showing as much force, like they're mad at us for the force that we've used. You know what I mean? Like, this is aggravating the situation.
But we were all so emotional. We were like,
uh-huh.
I don't
oh,
care.
Oh, no, totally.
I want that motherfucker to pay.
Totally.
Like, that's all we cared about. And
uh-huh.
It wasn't rational, you know? And she's giving interviews now where she's saying, like, I understood where the emotion was coming from, but you should want more from your elected
yep.
officials should be the ones who put their emotion aside to think it through.
Exactly.
Right?
Like, and to have a clear plan.
And that's what I was trying to do.
Right.
You know? So on the next day, September 15th, we were actively preparing for war.
Yeah.
So the president called everybody to Camp David. He's like, okay, what is our war strategy? We are going in. Here
yeah.
we fucking go, right?
Here we fucking go, man. Listen, are you ready? Oh, or that's how I
picture exactly
it.
That's exactly the vibe, right?
Yeah, it's for like real.
Extremely masculine energy. On September 20th, Bush addressed the nation and told us that Al-Qaeda was behind the terrorist attack. So that's first time.
He also sent out an ultimatum on September 20th to the Taliban government, along with the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, to turn over Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda leaders operating in the country or face attack.
Right.
And then the Taliban turned around and was like, well, we want evidence that bin Laden was even linked to those attacks if we're going to give him to you. So there was this kind of like, there was, I guess, a slight opportunity, I guess, quote unquote, that Bush was trying to implicate by saying like, hey, look, if you hand him over, we'll go easy on you.
Right.
That
which
kind
is
of thing.
Exactly. We talked about that in our What's in the News when we were talking about the situation currently in Afghanistan, where I was saying like, all of the people who want to now say, like, with all of this evidence that I've put out right now, right, about how we got in this situation in the first place, I don't think you can really argue that we went into Afghanistan on behalf of the Afghan people, because I feel like a lot of people will say that, like, we went in to save them from the Taliban. That's not why we went
in. I mean, maybe it morphed into that a little bit, but in the beginning, like, we wanted to kill the Taliban.
Because if the Taliban had handed over bin Laden at that moment, I don't think we ever would have gone in. Like, you know, like,
Bin Laden and named names of the people who aided and abetted him, we probably wouldn't have had a war. But then instead, the Taliban was like, well, but you don't know it was bin Laden. You don't, where's
the receipts?
Yeah. And they said, if there is evidence, then that would warrant a trial, which would be handled in Islamic court. So that was their response. And Bush was like, no, we're not going to stand for that. So the first U.S. attack on Afghanistan was on October 7th, 2001. And by November, we have been talking about Kabul a lot, the capital city of Afghanistan. That city fell by November to the Taliban. Also on October 7th, bin Laden released a video where he says, "What America is tasting now is only a copy of what we have tasted. Our Islamic nation has been tasting the same for more than 80 years of humiliation and disgrace. Its sons killed and their blood spilled. Its sanctities desecrated."
Listen. This is a real fine...
That was a long pause.
Well, because it's difficult, because this is a fine, like, walk to walk, right?
Totally.
Because it's just like, I don't condone violence, but like, I guess the point I'm trying to make in this first half, Maddie and I have decided we're going to split this episode up into two episodes because we are coming up on an hour right now.
Because, we can go real long.
And we have a lot more to discuss. But I do think that it is important... And it's why I wanted to make sure that we got a lot of the backstory of pre-9/11.
Yeah.
That it is important to understand that your colonialism and your capitalism have consequences. Right? Like, there are consequences. And absolutely, those consequences should never be 3,000 human lives. Like, that is devastating and heartbreaking, and I think I've made that very clear that that's how I feel about that.
Right.
However, when countries who have been exploited, residents of countries who have been exploited for a really long time say, hey, like, you've been exploiting us for a really long time and this is what it feels like, that's also true. I don't think that there's a...
Not saying, like, it's right. It's not. An eye for an eye is not right. None of it is right.
The actions aren't right.
Yeah.
The feelings are true.
Yes.
Though, like, those feelings of, like...
And that is setting us up for why we are in the problem... We're in the trouble that we're in now. The reason why... The people of Afghanistan fucking hate us, and why they have every right to, in a lot of ways, the civilians and people, you know what I mean? Like, there is so much that we have done to them, just like there is so much that they have done to us.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think trying to have the moral high ground because of one situation, which is a devastating... 9/11 was a horrifying moment. You know, that has, of course, all these repercussions and reverberations.
And when you have emotions tied to that.
Right, of course. But to say that, like, we are morally superior because you did this thing to us.
Exactly.
isn't fair.
Well, and to say that you're morally superior and then going and killing a bunch of people is an oxymoron. Like, that doesn't make any sense.
Right. I mean, I just think that it's important. It doesn't make the acts right. Of course, I'm not like siding with Osama bin Laden.
No. But
I'm just saying it is so vital that we have context.
Well, you have to understand both sides of a story in order to see a full picture.
Yeah. I mean, terrorism is terrorism. But yes.
Right. If we're talking about the actual acts of the day of 9/11, there isn't a lot of, I mean, it's very black and white, what's good and bad. If we're talking about the history of the tensions between the Middle East and the United States and those different sides of it, when we're talking about civilians and government, all these things, that's when we have to see both sides of the story and understand why, how do we get to this point?
I think that's what's important.
And I'm not saying that there's fault in any of it, but I think it's important to see other people's perspectives, even if it's twisted and wrong and it's something that we're never going to understand.
It's morphed into something twisted and wrong.
Right. And, like, you have to learn to understand that in order to learn anything from any sort of circumstances that we've been in. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to understand why this happened. Why did those attacks happen? Right. Why did this war happen? Why did it take 20 years for us to be living in this war? And I think that's why we have to take the time.
And to what end? I think that that's when we get to the end
of this. That's why we have to listen to other perspectives, even if it's not necessarily what we believe. We have to try to understand their side of things in order to get through it.
I don't think our listeners know that you're listening to a Pisces and a Cancer try to work our way
to, like, people who lead with our emotions and our feelings
and our hearts, right?
Trying to understand something that is so logical. But I think, but honestly, that's our superpower. Like, that's what I believe is my superpower, is my empathy.
Right.
Because I want to understand, even if that person is so fucked up and I don't want to agree with what they're saying there. And that's why I'm such a psychology nerd and a true crime nerd, because I'm like, I want to understand those who are different than me.
You can understand how a person got to a point.
Yes.
It doesn't excuse their behavior.
And it doesn't condone what their choices were.
At all.
But there is something. I think that there is so much to be learned from different perspectives, especially when it comes to the war on terror, because America has always been so, you know, had their blinders up.
We've tried to be morally superior through this whole thing.
And patriotic and all of this kind of stuff.
Yeah. And I feel like it's very apparent, or I hope it's very apparent, that I'm trying to balance this episode with my personal feelings of, like, grief and sadness and all of the feelings that we felt about that situation, with also not trying to say that the United States is morally superior in our response to a lot of what followed.
And I think that's the popular notion of today, of explaining why, yes, we had all this grief and sadness from this horrific event that happened in the United States. And all of us can feel that and have that be valid, and also realize that there are things happening that we have done to other countries that are just as bad and that make those people feel the same way.
Right. I mean, and
it's not taking a side. Yeah. It's just seeing the full picture.
And in our part two, we will also discuss, you know, how our grief and our sadness and our anger was immediately exploited. Like, it was, and that should piss you off.
Yes.
Like, that this thing that we had a legitimate reason to be, like, heartbroken and afraid of was exploited by our government right away.
Yeah.
Like, there were people in the Bush administration who were like, how can we spin this to get more oil? You know, like.
Well, I was always told too by my dad that the first Bush always wanted a war, and now the second Bush was able to give his daddy everything he ever wanted and that notoriety and all this kind of stuff, where it's like, it's not that, you know, it was like this perfect storm occurred while W was president that made him take advantage for his own political gain. And I don't have a lot of info on that in my notes or anything like that, but that was my perspective of it when I was younger, was that this guy was bloodthirsty and blood hungry and wanted this war, and then something happened that would warrant that kind of response, and he took it and ran with it.
You know, I don't know if I feel that way about George W. Bush, but I certainly feel that way about Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and like the people who were around him in the administration. 100% I feel
now
like that.
Now that I'm older and I understand a bit of, you know, that George W. Bush is kind of a dunce, you know, which I knew back
easily
then too.
Manipulated.
But you know, it's he's not that fucking smart. But I also know that he is surrounded by people that were very, very smart. And he was also very, very, very heavily influenced by his father, who was a big war guy, you know? So there's also those like personal and political motive that were going on in our president's mind that led him to manipulate a lot of us.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think we've ever stopped in the middle of an episode and decided to split it into two. But as you can see, there's so much here. There's so much here. And even the notes that I have, which we haven't even gotten into like half of them, are not everything.
Oh, we're still like within the week of 9/11 right now. Right. We got a lot to go.
Because there is so much and it is so complicated. Like maybe not complicated, but it's just like there are so many levels.
It's dense. All of it is very, very dense. And I knew that when taking my notes. So I'm like, this is gonna go so many different ways. But I'm really glad that we're gonna make this a two-parter because I think that it would be doing a disservice to rush what we're talking about.
So the second half, we'll be talking more about like the war on terror itself, being in it, and also a lot of the criticisms that came of it, also spinning off into the war in Iraq, which was like a whole beast in itself.
Yep.
So we'll discuss those things in part two.
But there is a lot still to come. And I think that definitely discussing about also how our lives drastically changed and how a lot of our, you know, Homeland Security became a thing. All this stuff, TSA became a thing. You know, there are so many things that we still have to cover. So hopefully all of you enjoyed this episode enough to tune in next week for our part two, where we will be discussing more about the war on terror in specifics. But like Keegan said earlier in the episode, I would love to hear people's "Where was I when 9/11 happened?" stories.
Yeah, what were my feelings about it? What are my feelings now? Because it does change.
Yeah,
like, you know.
So you were searching for your mom's keys, you said?
Yeah, so.
And why weren't you at school?
I had pink eye.
Oh my gosh.
I had pink eye. I was in sixth grade. I had pink eye. The night before, there was like an event in the park. I think it was something where it was some kind of community event.
Right.
And so we were there. And then the next morning, we lived not far from the park. It was a small town in Missouri. And so we lived like just down the road. And my mom was like, "Oh, I forgot my keys. You're not going to school because you're sick. Do you want to come with me to help me look for the keys?" So I was like, "Yes." We went, we were looking for them in the grass. We found them. We went back in the car, we turned on the car, and they were talking about it. Like it was because it didn't matter what station you were listening to.
Everywhere.
Every radio station.
Every TV station, changed. Everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah. They changed whatever they were playing to talk about what was going on. And so my mom, like I didn't understand it. I was like, I don't know what the World Trade Centers are.
Yeah.
Like I didn't understand it, but my mom, I could tell like something was wrong. So she sped back, which again was like half a mile down the road, like not far. We got inside. My aunt already had the TV on. So mom is there. She's got her hands over her face.
Yeah.
They're freaking out.
Yeah.
And that's when we see the second plane hit the second tower.
Wow.
And it was like, I didn't understand the significance, but I knew that because
of their reactions.
And yes. That, yeah. Like, and it was on every station and like, I don't think
whatever it was, it was big.
See, I don't think I went to work the next day either.
You didn't go to work the next day?
Work, school.
I was in prayer circle. We started every morning with a circle. We turned the lights down and we lit like flameless candles. And it was like a very like peaceful way to start the morning. And so, you know, it's dark and we're all, you know, in Mrs. Johnson's fourth grade class praying. And our principal, Mrs. Schmidt, comes to the door and pulls Mrs. Johnson out and talks to her. And she comes in and I don't remember what she said, but I remember the way that I perceived it was that it was a plane crash. and that a lot of people died. And in my head, but like, again, on the adults' faces, I could see that something was seriously wrong. But in my head, I'm like, yes, this is very sad. And a lot of people died in this plane crash. But what's more? Why is everybody freaking out so
much? Right. I mean, I kind of felt the same way because we had just come off of Aaliyah. Right.
Yes.
Like, and that had happened when I was in school as well. And they actually showed it on like the in-school news.
Did
right?
they?
That we had every morning.
Oh, I was too young for that. Yeah.
And they were telling us about like Aaliyah's plane crashing and all of them dying. And so yeah. It was kind of coming off of that. And that was the level of tragedy I was used to.
Right,
I wasn't used to it on this
same.
Scale. Right?
So to me, I was like, yes, this is very sad. There was a plane crash and whatever. But my mom was already working as a lunch lady at my school at that point. And I remember talking to her because I would always like go into the actual kitchen and like hang out and whatever with my mom and her kind of explaining it to me a bit more. But it wasn't until I got home and I just remember like putting my chin on my mom's shoulder and we had this like tiny, like 4-inch TV. Like it was the tiniest TV ever. And watching the footage over and over again, just kind of looking over her shoulder while she's doing her like beadwork and stuff. And having that be the moment where it sunk into me that this wasn't a plane crash. Like this was
bigger.
Scary and bigger
yeah.
and real.
Yeah.
And that's the image in my head of just like, I can feel my chin on her shoulder and watching those things and just being like every moment of every bit of safety that I felt just kind of fell away
and
from
it,
me.
It was the nation's reaction to it as well, where
yeah.
like you're watching by the evening, you know, you're watching New Yorkers gather and they're singing songs together and lighting candles. And
yeah.
you're watching the missing posters go up all across New York City and you're watching.
It's starting to sink in
the
that
president
this is.
Give an address and
yeah.
you're like, oh, something enormous and like life altering has happened.
Yeah.
Today.
I mean, luckily I was not. I think I probably went and turned on cartoons at some point during the night. You know, I was 9, so I wasn't like, let me watch all this news.
Same.
You know, everything
I mean,
that's
going
on.
We slept in the living room, but at some point us kids were kind of like, okay. Like,
yeah, you know, yeah. I definitely went on with my day and my life, but just, I mean, that was all we talked about
yeah.
for a very long time, and especially having a dad that was so political and outspoken liberally, I became very aware very, very fast of what all of that meant. But the night of, it was a lot of just that imagery
yeah.
and a lot of fear. So
yeah.
I would love to hear the stories of what all of your experiences were. I know we have a lot of very young listeners, but for those of you who are alive during this, if you'd like to...
let me know what it's like hearing it secondhand, because I have no idea.
Oh,
like,
for real.
What is it like hearing these stories through other people if
what
you
is
weren't
it like
around? You
thinking
know?
That the TSA wasn't a thing. At one point,
right.
that you could walk someone all the way up to the gate.
Back in my day, you could walk somebody right up to the gate and give them a hug before they got on the
plane. And wave away as they fly off into their destination. Yeah, fucking wild shit. So if you have any thoughts and feelings, let's just say that. Any thoughts and feelings, send it to us. We'll read them on a news episode. We're going to talk about it. This is something that obviously is very near and dear to both of our hearts and we care a lot about. So again, thank you so much for listening to part one. I think this is the first time we're splitting this shit into a two-parter. So we're hitting a new era here. So I'm going to do my regular spiel now. How do I start it? If you do want to send us in your thoughts and feelings, go ahead and email us at neighborhoodfeminist@gmail.com or direct message us on Instagram at @angryneighborhoodfeminist. We have a Facebook group and business page. You can go to the business page and rate and review us and then go to the group page and chat with your fellow listeners who are all so wonderful. And we would also really, really greatly appreciate it if you haven't done so already, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It is the best way for you to show us your love and support, and we really do appreciate it so much. All right, that's all we have today. With all of that being said, we encourage you to rage on.
Bye.